This is Jeff Blankford with the August 9th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Today, August 9th, marks the 72nd anniversary of the atomic bombing of the Japanese city of Nagasaki by the United States Air Force. It was not only one of the most shameful moments in the history of this country, but also, I will argue, the most egregious act of state terror ever committed by the people of one country against the people of another. From a moral perspective, I consider it to have been worse than the bombing of Hiroshima. And why do I make that distinction? Because despite having been made aware of the extent of death and devastation in Hiroshima, President Truman and his military advisors went ahead with their plans to drop a second bomb of a different type on another Japanese city to see if the effects were comparable. None of the war criminals responsible for these atrocities were ever brought to trial, and no attempt was made to do so. And to my knowledge, none ever apologized. Nor were they expected to by the majority of American public conditioned to see the Japanese as less than human, as in future wars they would view Koreans and Vietnamese. President Obama was the first American president to visit Hiroshima. He did so on last year's anniversary of the bombing, but he was not about to offer America's apology for its crimes. That was established in the media before his trip. Had he done so, of course, in a sudden attack of conscience, he would have been pilloried by the same media and Congress. But then, while on the same trip, he also couldn't bring himself to apologize to either the Vietnamese or Laotians for the unspeakable war crimes the U.S. had committed against the peoples of both of those countries. "Americans don't apologize," was his unspoken message to the world. Like it or not, and I don't, it is who we are. Estimates of the number of dead and injured in both bombings made by American officials, 175,000 in Hiroshima and half of that in Nagasaki, are thought by critics of the bombing to be understated. The extent and type of devastation made accurate body counts impossible. The U.S. testing of ever more powerful bombs over the Marshall Islands, and particularly the Bikini Atoll, in the subsequent decades have been largely forgotten, except by the survivors and their descendants, whose lives and lands were made permanently uninhabitable. Following the first bombing of Bikini in 1946, a French fashion designer, Louis Rayard, produced a woman's swimsuit and named it after the demolished island, presumably because, like the atoll, there wasn't much left to see. All of this is relevant today because for the first time since the end of the Cold War, the threat of nuclear war that would engulf the world is not a fantasy, and the fear of mad, mutually assured destruction that held it back no longer seems to anchor reality. Is it any surprise that actions by the United States have been largely responsible for this new threat, and that Russia is once again cast in the role of our adversary? Beginning with Washington's unquestioned role in promoting the 2014 Ukraine coup and using Russia's clearly anticipated reaction to that event, the retaking of Crimea, as justification to move NATO's troops to Russia's borders, followed by the yet-to-be-proven accusation that Moscow interfered in our presidential election, the confrontation between the world's two nuclear powers is moving dangerously apace. It should also not be forgotten that President Obama, who had promised a cutback in America's nuclear arsenal when he came into office, used Russia's annexation of Crimea as an excuse to set the United States upon a trillion-dollar path to replace what he described as aging missile silos, 1950s-era bombers, and other outdated technology. The Nobel Peace Prize winner described the steps as intended to maintain America's present capabilities into the future, not bulking up to prepare for a nuclear war. The most recent aggressive act on Washington's part was Congress's approval by almost unanimous votes in both houses of the harshest sanctions on Russia to date, as well as adding sanctions on Iran and North Korea. Those sanctions have not gone down well with any of their targets, but those against Russia have angered our European allies, whose important commercial relations with Moscow these sanctions were apparently designed to scuttle. Both of those subjects, the increasing danger of nuclear war and Europe's response to the imposition of the new sanctions, are what I will be discussing at 20 minutes past the hour with an old friend, Paris-based journalist Diana Johnstone. We'll be speaking about a recent article on Counterpunch called Collateral Damage, U.S. Sanctions Aimed at Russia Strike Western European Allies, and From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon Nuclear War Planning, a deathbed memoir by her father, Paul Johnstone, former senior analyst in the Strategic Weapons Evaluation Group in the Pentagon, and a co-author of the Pentagon Papers, which was issued in paperback on April 1st. Speaking of Congress, in her Counterpunch article, Johnstone asks, do they realize that the measures amount to a declaration of economic war against their European friends? Whether they know it or not, they obviously don't care. U.S. politicians, he writes, view the rest of the world as America's hinterland to be exploited, abused, and ignored with impunity. That's from Diana Johnstone, and we will be hearing more from her at 20 minutes past, so stay tuned. One more important item relating to the sanctions is worth noting, since the mainstream and alternative media have ignored it, which is particularly significant because those added sanctions on Russia were based on the still-not-proven allegations of Russian hacking of Democratic Party emails. On July 24th, the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, a group of former employees of the CIA, NSA, FBI, etc., several of whom you have heard on this and other programs on KZYX, sent a memo to President Trump challenging the conclusions of the U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia was the guilty party. According to the report's executive summary, quote, forensic studies of Russian hacking into the Democratic National Committee computers last year revealed that on July 5, 2016, data was leaked, not hacked, by a person with physical access to DNC computers and then doctored to incriminate Russia. After examining metadata from Guccifer II, July 15, 2016 intrusion into the DNC server, the memo continued, independent cyber investigators have concluded that an insider copied DNC data onto an external storage drive and that telltale signs implicating Russia were then inserted. Key among the findings of the independent forensic investigations is the conclusion the DNC data was copied onto a storage device at a speed that far exceeds an internet capability for a remote hack. The last line was in boldface for emphasis and worth repeating. The DNC data was copied onto a storage device at a speed that far exceeds an internet capability for a remote hack. End quote. Of equal importance, the memo continued, the forensics showed the copying and doctoring were performed on the East Coast of the U.S. Thus far, mainstream media have ignored the findings of these independent studies. End quote. Only two U.S. publications, the Washington Times and the Baltimore Sun, carried their report, or story of their report. Who were these former intelligence professionals whose opinion the U.S. media did not want the public to know about? The most familiar names of the 17 who cited are probably Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst during the Reagan administration, and Colleen Rowley, formerly with the FBI, whose whistleblowing made national news. Then there's William Binney, former NSA Technical Director for World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and co-founder of NSA's Signals Intelligence Automation Research Center, Kirk Wabey, a former senior analyst also at the NSA's Signals Intelligence Automation Research Center, and John Kiraku, former CIA counterterrorism officer and former senior investigator of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You can find the entire memo published on Consortium News July 24th online under the headline, Intel Vets Challenge Russia Hack Evidence. North Korea is another story. President Trump unfortunately took time off from his golfing vacation yesterday to warn North Korea that it would face, quote, fire and fury like the world has never known if it threatened the United States. Sure enough, just hours later, two North Korean generals responded that their country is, quote, carefully examining, end quote, plans for a missile strike on the U.S. Pacific colony of Guam, home base of the strategic bombers that have begun to routinely fly over the Korean Peninsula as a demonstration of U.S. air power. If there's any good news to be taken from this story, is that it was the generals responding to President Trump, not Kim Jong-un. On another front, there appears to be no end to the New York Times pandering to those whose interest would be served by the U.S. either breaking the nuclear deal with Iran, actually launching an attack on Tehran, or sending thousands more troops to Afghanistan to prevent the Iranians from filling the vacuum that would be caused by an American withdrawal. A week ago Sunday, The Times, which has lied to the American people about every war or overseas misadventure the U.S. has engaged in since World War II, ran a 4,000-word article based largely on hearsay that will lead the paper's readers to believe that Iran has taken over Iraq and Syria and will do the same in Afghanistan unless thousands more U.S. soldiers are sent there to prevent it. The best remedy for that piece of propaganda is to take a look at a map of the U.S. military bases in the area. They show Iran to be completely surrounded. Some good news. Listeners to Takes on the World 2 weeks ago heard Grant Smith of IRMEP, the Institute for Research for Middle Eastern Policy, break down the serious problems inherent in the Anti-Israel Boycott Act, SB 720, currently being sponsored by a majority of members of the House and nearly half the Senate. The bill would make advocating or participating in boycotting, sanctioning, or divesting from Israel a felony punishable by up to $1 million in fines and 20 years in prison. Not kidding. It would also amend certain critical U.S. statutes to make fair binding U.S. law. For those who have heard me describe Congress as Israel's most important occupied territory, the progress of such legislation pushed by AIPAC comes as no surprise. But what will come as a surprise, and much a welcome one, is that Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, elected to the Senate seat vacated by Hillary Clinton when she first ran for president, has made history by becoming the first U.S. senator to ask to have her name removed from a piece of AIPAC-promoted legislation. At two town hall meetings last month, Gillibrand promised to reconsider her co-sponsorship of the bill after a number of her constituents raised free speech concerns to rousing applause. It did not take long for AIPAC, recognizing the historic nature of Gillibrand's challenge, to begin mobilizing its troops against her. The first strike was an email from Brian Tregerman, AIPAC's director for Westchester and Riverdale, New York, on August 2nd. The subject line read, "Urgent. We need your help from Senator Gillibrand." And that began the message. New York's junior Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has withdrawn her co-sponsorship of the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, sending a powerful message to her constituents that she no longer supports the fight to combat the international delegitimization of Israel. Please call Senator Gillibrand's office today at 202-224-4451 and remind her how crucial this bill is in combating the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement and reaffirming congressional support for Israel, end quote. This was followed by a suggesting sample telephone message and a list of talking points, the first and most interesting one being that, quote, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, Senate Bill 720, would expand existing U.S. anti-boycott laws to international governmental organizations like the United Nations and the European Union, end quote, implying that actions of both these organizations that include America's closest allies are illegitimate. You will recall in my last program I discussed with Grant Smith the unsuccessful efforts of President Kennedy to have Israel's lobbying organization at the time, American Zionist Council, and his staff register as agents of a foreign country. Smith also described his own well-documented efforts to have JFK's wishes realized and how those were thwarted by the Justice Department's Foreign Agents Registration Agency. If AIPAC was registered as a foreign agent, it could not have sent such messages to voters as was done in the case of Gillibrand, and we would not see congressional legislation that would scrap our First Amendment and further enshrine Israel within the inner workings of the U.S. government. Quite out of the blue, the question of whether AIPAC should have to register as a foreign agent was raised by none other than Senator Lindsey Graham at the hearings of the Senate Judiciary Committee on possible Russian involvement in the U.S. political process. Listen to him asking the question of Adam Hickey, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Justice Department's National Security Division, and the mealy-mouthed answer he gets in response.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to add my compliments to you and the ranking member for conducting a very organized way forward in terms of dealing with the threats we face as a nation and changing our laws. That's nice. Consistent with those threats. I am too disappointed that we have a two-hour rule on something this important. two hearings I know of have been canceled because we can't agree on health care, but we should be able to agree this is important. Mr. Browder's got a lot to say. So here's the deal. AIPAC, are you familiar with AIPAC? American Israeli Political Action Committee.
I have heard of it, sir, yes.
Okay. They come up here in droves, lobbying Congress to do things, in their view, good for the U.S.-Israel relationship. I know they have a lot of contacts in Israel. Should somebody like that be a foreign agent?
Sir, it's probably not appropriate for me to comment on a particular entity, but I think you've hit on something very important to us, which is right now we rely principally on public reports for the basis to send voluntary letters of inquiry. I would love to receive more information in whatever form anyone can give it to me about what's occurring behind closed doors so we are able to take steps to investigate if appropriate.
In November 2009, as you heard, 2 weeks ago, Grant Smith met for 2 hours with the head and staff members of the Foreign Agents Registration Agency of the Justice Department and presented them with more than 300 pages of evidence, including files that had been recently declassified, clearly establishing beyond a doubt that AIPAC was working as a foreign agent for Israel and calling on the agency to register as such. Grant Smith never heard from them again. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.